There is a story in the Book of Mormon of a man named Lehi who was a prophet. He had a dream where he saw a tree of light, which he came to understand as the representation of all light, knowledge, and truth in the universe. Leading to that tree was an iron rod along a straight, narrow path. Clinging to the rod were the righteous souls of the earth who desired to eat the fruit of the sacred tree. Away from the straight, narrow path and the rod of iron, there was a great ravine. On the other side of the ravine, there was a great and spacious building where all the wicked souls of the earth were presumably doing Molly and watching David Lynch movies or something like that. The basic idea was that the path of righteousness is a treacherous path. Those who desire the fruit of the tree of light had to cling to the rod of iron with all their might to maintain their footing and avoid tumbling perilously into the ravine. Growing up a faithful member of the LDS Church, this is how I experienced my faith. It was a fragile and vulnerable thing. If it wasn't protected diligently, it could easily crumble and fall away. I was advised to avoid certain types of kids when choosing friend groups, certain types of music, movies, and television shows. But perhaps the scariest boogeyman for any true believing member of the LDS faith is any book, essay, or article that has been designated by church leadership as anti-Mormon literature. This was essentially any writing that was critical of the LDS faith or that sought to reframe traditional narratives within the church, citing historical records, which the church did not recognize or teach, but which were a matter of public record to anyone outside the faith. At the time, the concept of having to protect my delicate faith was an inspiring one. It gave me the feeling that I was clinging to something precious and fighting against the odds to preserve the purity of these things I believed to be true. 15 years removed from any organized religion, I have an entirely different view. It seems to me now that in order for genuine critical thinking and reasoning to be possible, all ideas need to be able to be entertained and considered in hopes that the best ideas will win out. My guest today had a very similar upbringing as I did, with a few very specific differences. Most glaringly to me is the fact that he was able to protect and preserve his faith into his adulthood. It wasn't until a few short years ago that things started to unravel for him. From a Blanket Fort recording studio in a one-bedroom apartment in North Hollywood, this is People Pleaser. I'm Austin Archer, and today I'm talking to my friend Christopher Schenefeldt about his faith transition and about the new book he just self-published on Amazon, Deconstructing Mormonism from an Insider Perspective, aptly titled, you guessed it, Anti-Mormon Literature. So let's talk a little bit about that. How you were raised and what life was like growing up.
Yeah, so I mean, I was born an indoctrinated Mormon, as I say.
Mm-hmm.
My father was actually a non-member, so I had an early mix of religions early on in my life. My mom was a heavy influence and obviously took the Mormon track versus the Catholic track. But I had a lot of influence and experiences with my...
Is your dad Catholic?
He has since converted.
Familially Catholic or just...
Yeah, like when I was growing up, I don't ever really recall him attending, not even really Christmas or Easter Mass, to my recollection. I think maybe his mom went on occasion, but I don't know if my granddad really did either. So they weren't like... very practicing as far as I knew. And I don't really know what he necessarily believed actually the whole time I was growing up. We just kind of followed my mom's faith and, the grandfather on that side. And, that's just kind of how we rolled, even though we had influence from the other side.
I grew up in a neighborhood with a few kind of like mixed, I don't know what you would call it. I think they call it
mixed faith households.
Yeah. I was gonna say like mixed orientation, but I'm like, that doesn't seem
not quite yeah.
right. Mixed faith households, and it always seems like Mormonism wins out. And I think I interpreted that as a kid to mean like, well, of course it wins out. Like,
yeah, if, exactly.
Like, given the option between Mormonism and any other faith, of course Mormonism's gonna
win out.
You tell
it's
the
true.
Kids, hey, we can go to either church, whichever one you guys want, and then the kids are all like, well, we want to go with the one where we feel. And it's like, no, they want to go to the one where all their friends go to.
Yeah, exactly.
They're raised in Utah. They're raised in Cottonwood Heights, Utah, or Kaysville, Utah, or Bountiful, Utah. You want to go to the one that all your neighbors go to.
Yeah, not the like dark, cold one with the stained glass that one kid in your neighborhood might go to yeah. occasionally. Yeah. Like,
you want to go to scout camp and mutual and exactly. do all that stuff. Yeah. And also, it's just, I mean, the societal pressure to, you know,
a lot of pressure.
Yeah. So anyway, keep yeah.
So I mean where do we jump to next? You said a lot of people kind of know the spiel.
Well,
now.
Okay,
I mean,
you know, so would you say that growing up you were a full TBM, and for those who don't know, TBM means true believing member. Would you say that you were like a person who had a testimony of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints? Like you, if asked or pressed, you were
ready to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. TBM all the way. I didn't really start thinking about other religions or like what they might really believe in comparison to ours until like college. So mm-hmm. like my whole formative adolescent years, just, you know, waiting to get priesthood number one so I can pass the sacrament and do whatever else they do, collect money from mm-hmm. people so that, you know, the building can be cleaned for free by those same people. yeah, just kind of took it in stride until up to college when I really had to start, like, I mean, maybe last half of senior year, like getting ready to go on a mission, because that's the next big expectation. Like, yeah, you can do a year of college if you want. The age can kind of make it work either way. We encourage you to go on a mission right now, but no more than 1 year of college, and then, you know, get your ass out there.
Were you excited? I was so excited, dude. I thought I was going to be, because I'm like, you know, I'm a pretty gregarious person.
Yeah.
And I also, I fancy myself like a good debater and a good linguist. And I was just excited to get out there and like blow people's minds. I was excited. I was Elder Price. Like I really was.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. I was like, I'm going to go out there and fucking like drop bombs on people. Like, they're going to be blown away at what a good missionary I am.
Yeah. No, mine was the opposite. I was only Elder Price because I got sent to West Africa.
Okay.
I wasn't him because of the enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was really nervous. I didn't want to go a lot for medical reasons. I have fibromyalgia. So even then, I was like, am I up to the task, even depending on where they send me? And I knew I wasn't a good salesman. I even said it back then. Like, I knew being a missionary was essentially being a salesman. You go tract and knock on doors and try to convince people to buy your product. I even had that view back before my mission, and I knew I was just going to be terrible at it, but I knew, like, if anyone ever wanted to talk about it, like you said, like, you're out in New York and someone hears you're a Mormon and then they want to hear about it, at that point, I'm ready because, like, they've initiated it. It wasn't really my thing to go around and be like, hey, have you heard about what I believe? If it, like, comes up in conversation, I was like, yeah, I'll absolutely talk about it.
I was an obnoxious little fucker. Like I gave my freshman year roommate in college a really nice copy of the Book of Mormon because he had asked me this question. He was like, because we were talking about how I was going on a mission. I was supposed to be going to one semester of school.
Oh, just one
semester.
And
I wasn't
semester.
Supposed to go to spring semester. My birthday's in January. I was going to leave after that. And he asked me the question. He was like, are you sure that like you have experienced enough things in life to like be a salesman for this thing? Like don't you want to try out a few different things or try to learn a few different other things before you kind of say, this is what I think and this is how my brain works? And what I wrote in the book to him, and I think about this all the time because I just like, it just one of those things that makes me cringe, but I wrote, everything I'll ever need to know is in this book. And I gave it to him.
I mean, I definitely had phases like that. I think everyone does. I think it's just part of my personality. Like, most of the time, I don't have the energy to, like, push it on people, but yeah. I'm always happy to talk about it. Uh-huh. But yeah, definitely, like, I gave some people Book of Mormons and things like that. Yeah. But, like, I never felt like I'd be that missionary that you hear about who's, like, on a 3-hour bus ride in Brazil and stands up and gives his testimony to all the strangers that he's never talked to and ends up converting like at least 4 of them.
Yeah.
I never thought I'd have the will to do that. Yeah. But I mean, you bring up a friend who kind of talked to you about the mission when we were doing Assassins. That was really like right before, like I was doing my papers while we were working on Assassins at Weber. And I went to dinner with an LDS friend of ours who was in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like told him all the reasons I was unsure.
Mm-hmm.
I remembered for a long time what he said, but it's been so long now I don't remember. But it had the effect on me where I inevitably made the decision during that dinner to go. So I had a friend kind of have the
You'll have to tell me after we're done who it was.
Yeah.
We won't blow up his spot on the podcast, but you can tell me afterward who it was.
Yeah.
I did that for a few friends. Chrissy Bear, who mixes and masters of the show, he gives me shit about it all the time. I convinced him to go on his mission. I called him and I said, "You're gonna regret it for the rest of your life if you don't do this." And
it was probably along the same lines. Yeah.
And I was like, "Dude, like you get one shot to have this experience, you know." And so he's out there in Houston, Texas, on his mission, and he calls us one day from a payphone. Me and my friends are all hanging out, and he's out on his mission. And I had since chosen not to go on my mission.
You asshole.
And he calls me for his mission, and he goes, "What the hell's wrong with you?" He's like, You're the whole reason I'm out here. You're not going." And I was like, "Well, people change, bud."
Oh my God, that is hilarious. I didn't know that.
He's just like, "I can't believe you." Yeah. So yeah, I did that. You know, I was a proselytizer. I fancied myself as like kind of an edgy kid, as an edgy Mormon, because I swore. I watched rated R movies. I was a real horny. I didn't know at the time that was normal.
I thought I
was extra horny because I was the only one of my friend group who would really like talk about it.
Same. No,
in
I
a
was
very
that
candid
friend.
Way. Yeah. And my friends would be like, "I would never do that." And then later on in life, they were all like, "Yeah, I was just as, totally. I was of course just as horny as you were." But I was the one who we would like have conversations where they'd be like, "If the hottest girl in school came into your room and said she wants to get it on, what would you do?" And all the other guys would be like, "You know what? I'd say no, man. I'd say no." And it gets to me, I'd be like, "I'm sorry, guys. I would have to just apologize to the bishop later."
I had that experience.
In real life. I think I knew this about you, that you were like, even as a Mormon kid, you were like getting it on.
It was my struggle, honestly. Yeah.
Is you were too sexy. People couldn't resist you. Like, people couldn't resist your vibes, and you couldn't say no when they would come to you with the thirst.
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, there were definitely times I slipped up, but there were times in particular where I definitely said no in a very awkward circumstance and left the house. And looking back on that hurts sometimes.
the reality is, and I was just out on a camping trip with a bunch of my friends from high school who are, many of them are still LDS and love these guys, always will. They're my brothers. But we were talking about that, like those conversations. And I was like, here's the reality is at that age, had that situation happened where girl that I have a crush on from school who I think is super hot comes over to my house and like wants to get it on, I wouldn't have been able to. Just because of sheer just terror and existential, I would have wanted to, but I would have freaked out and then kicked myself for years afterward going, I can't believe she was in my room.
Yeah.
That's yeah. what it is. You got all that though, all that stuff, all the shame around sex and all the, you know,
oh, 100%
feeling like an awful person because you're masturbating and all that stuff.
Yeah. Well, and also, you know, feeling the shame and guilt of the times. Cause like everyone's also lied about it so mm-hmm. that you can get a temple recommend or go on a mission. Like I had friends who lied about things and then were out on the mission and had so much guilt they had to come home and deal with it and then go out again because they lied. So there's a lot of shame and guilt around it, like either way, whether you're hiding it or not.
Yeah, totally. And that's a whole other aspect is being raised in a community with kind of substandard sex education and not really having a healthy view of it. And I don't know, did you wind up doing that before or after your mission? Did you ever do it or?
Oh, I mean, after. Yeah.
You did it before you got married, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Oh yeah. The kiddo came along. Did it kill you? Like it's a complicated thing to look back on. Like personally, no, like I made the choice when I did for an obvious reason. Uh-huh. And like, there's, when you look at like sexuality spectrums, I understand a lot about that more now. And like when I inevitably made certain choices, it was more so hard for like people who loved me to undertake. Like I was ready to, and, I was kind of like how you felt, like kind of an edgy Mormon in those ways. Like when I met Megan, all of her friends were like, hey, but he's Mormon. What are you doing?
Yeah.
But she'd always tell me, but you're like one of the most interesting Mormons I've met. Like you don't treat me like the rest of them do. And you're like, oh, you're comfortable in more situations. So I took it more, I think a lot better than those who loved me did. I would like, even through like disfellowshment processes that I had to go through on more than one occasion. And we can get into those kind of things too.
You went through a process of being,
I was disfellowshipped twice. So it's
really,
like, yeah, it's a layer under being excommunicated.
Were you ever excommunicated or did you just
no,
leave?
No, still not. I haven't had anyone call me to a counselor or anything.
Are your records in?
They are. Like I started the process of removing them, but there's a lot of like legal reasons why that's cumbersome now. The church halts a lot. And yeah, there's like only one.
I haven't done it. I haven't gone to church, and I mean, I haven't been a member of the church for 15 years, and I don't think I'm hanging on to it. It's just kind of like something that I just am like, I don't recognize the authority of whatever piece of paper you have my name on. Like yeah. I just am sort of like, I personally don't endow that with any meaning, you know, like if I'm one of the people that you're counting amongst your numbers, like my behavior and the way I live my life would say otherwise, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
no,
I
said in a TikTok recently, cause someone brought this subject up of, have you had your records removed or not? And why? And my view, even back then, and because I had gone through the disfellowship process, like at that point I was just over it so much, like the effort to have my name removed from this thing that I don't believe is true anyway, when there might be a layer where even though I might get a confirmation that they did, do I believe that they really did? That's something to consider. But also I just figured at a point it may get to a point where they excommunicate me. I mean, it could, depending.
I was just going to say, do you think that might be coming with this book?
It has the potential. I mean, just for sheer like polemic reasons, not necessarily because of all the content within, but because of reactions that certain aspects of it might get. But my view of that is just like, sure, be my secretary, like take care of the paperwork for me.
Yeah.
And then I don't have to worry about it.
Yeah. Like I'm not going to show up to the
exactly.
hearing.
Exactly. Yeah. So. There's no point. Like at this point, the bishop near me doesn't know who I am. I've never met them.
Yeah.
Why would I show up and talk to them about it anyway? If I am, I'm going to order them a pizza and send a copy of the book along the way. And
yeah, the most the most famous one recently was that, I can't remember her name, but my dad and I were talking about it this morning, that woman who was the sex therapist.
Yeah, Natasha Helfer, I think.
And which, that was just crazy. It's like they really never miss an opportunity to like dig their heels into the past. Like, it's just kind of like,
never.
You just have an opportunity here to like listen to someone who's more qualified than you to speak on this issue. Mm-hmm. And she literally probably in a room full of men who she's more qualified on this topic than every single person in the room.
No doubt.
And they're having a hearing on whether or not she can be part of their club. And she wants in. She wants to be there. She wants to be a participating, tithe paying member, and they're kicking her out for being medically accurate about sex health.
Yeah, it's 100% crazy. I haven't followed the story for a while.
Yeah, but I didn't follow it. I didn't know much about it. I actually learned about it from that woman I had on my podcast, Carly. I learned about it from there, and I was like reading some of the posts that this woman made, and I was like, my God, she's so reasonable.
Yeah.
And so like level-headed and smart and seems so earnestly to want to stay and want to be a part of this community. And they're just like, well, how dare you teach clinically researched theories about sexual health?
It really it screams of like transgenerational ingrained, like heretic treatment, like Galileo talking about how the universe and the planets might actually be aligned, you know, can get you killed. It's along the same lines in this day and age. Like just saying, you know, there's certain things about our bodies and how people feel and things regarding sex that you're actually wrong about, and it's more healthy to deal with them in this way. And they can just go, well, no. And
you're not allowed to say that.
Yeah. Well, we're not killing them anymore.
Yeah.
But we're saying you can't be part of the club anymore.
You can't be part of the club because you're saying bad things.
Yeah.
And it's like, but I'm, yeah, it's so bizarre. And it is just another thing where you just go, boy, you really didn't have to do that. Like, you didn't have to, like, take that opportunity to once again opt for the regressive stance. It's kind of like, you know, coming out and letting everyone know that BYU did not sanction the Rainbow Day.
Oh,
it's like, hey,
God,
guys, you don't need to say anything. You don't need to say anything. You can just be like, hey, look, some of our students organized an appreciation day of the gay students who are on our campus. And you didn't need to say anything. But you have to come out and be like, just, and I made a TikTok about it too, where it's like, hey, just so everyone knows, we still hate gay people. And it's like, yeah, we know. Like, until you make a statement to the contrary, until you come out as a leadership and say, hey, we're actually fully accepting and allowing gay people to participate in our organization, we will assume that nothing has changed. You don't need to every few years be like, hey, everyone still knows that
we're anti-LGBTQ, right?
You guys all still know that, right? It's like, yeah, thank you.
It's been confirmed since 1995. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for saying it again. Thank you. I think more or less what we just did was like qualified you as a bona fide Mormon, you know, qualified you and myself, even though I didn't go on a mission, you know, like we were believers, you know, we were people who did this week in, week out. This is the community we associated with, the community that we based all of our major life decisions on. Where do cracks first start emerging for you? And like, what is sort of the impetus for that?
There's probably like three different instances, really. The first, like early on, was right before my mission, which I've kind of already covered.
Uh-huh.
Like I had doubts that I'd be able to fulfill like the role of a missionary, and then coming back and being the, you know, father figure, for a lot of different reasons. I had doubts that I was going to be able to fulfill what they had told me I needed to do in life. But then, you know, inevitably I had that friend convince me to go out. And then coming back, the first year back was pretty difficult, coming home early from the mission. And it wasn't long after. I wasn't quite sure. I needed a minor for school, but I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. So I jumped through a lot of different things. And along the way, I was wondering if I wanted to do some sort of like philosophy or religious studies track. So I started reading a lot of other cultures' texts, like the Talmud and the Quran and the Bhagavad Gita, and just trying to get all these different views in and compare it with these. Because I considered, you know, moving to BYU and doing the sure. Mormon version of it, and comparing all the other religions to what I had already knew and experienced through Mormonism, and through all that, I didn't really have much trouble reading other religious texts, but I think it was like late 2009 through 2010 I read my first atheist book.
Oh.
Which was God Is Not Great by Christopher Hitchens. And
great place to start.
Yeah. Well,
boy, that'll do it.
Well, it did. It had an opposite effect at first.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. This was like 11 years ago now.
Yeah.
And I only read like the first 2.5, maybe 3.5 chapters
mm-hmm.
before. And there were even mentions, I think, at that point of Mormonism.
Frustrated and mad? Or
yeah. Because I was just like, this isn't the God that I know. And I can see how all of his experiences in these other countries with these other religions, whether Christian or not, still they don't line up with what I know, but they do line up with what I've been taught is wrong about the rest of the world. And so I shut the book because it kind of scared me.
Yeah,
and
sure.
I didn't look.
That's actually a really great intro into the us talking about the idea of, and I want, that was the second one, right? The God Is Not Great, or of the three that you were talking about?
Of the three, maybe.
You were like, there's like three events that were like,
oh yeah,
cracks in the story.
That was like number two, because that was like the first one post-mission, and then there wasn't anything for like another 7 or 8 years.
Before we get to the last one, though, I want to jump on that, because yeah, this idea of, and it's such a great title for your book, Anti-Mormon Literature, because anyone who was raised LDS knows that terminology. And it's essentially any literature, novel, article, anything like that, that is critical or attempts to deconstruct or examine the church through any lens that isn't the agreed upon, pulpit approved, you know, like top down lens. And if it sounds at all like you're trying to convince people of an alternate narrative of how things could have gone down, it becomes labeled anti-Mormon literature. And certainly Christopher Hitchens would qualify for that. And that I relate to that experience of like being scared by information that, because at the time, yeah, if my conception of God now is not that God, I don't believe in a God or a higher power that is, malicious or that intends to inflict suffering on people, or that wants people, that thinks that suffering is necessary in order to achieve some kind of award or reward, anything like that. But that's not who Christopher Hitchens is talking about in that book. He's not even talking about a real thing. He's talking about the conception of God as purported and exercised by the majority of mainstream religions in the world. Like this idea of a God who, it does require suffering in order to achieve certain ends and rewards, you know, and kind of a masochistic God that like,
very much so.
Yeah. You know, and it's hard to conceive of that when your relationship with, when you're a believing person in a religion and your relationship with whatever you conceive God to be is like, I always feel like God's very kind with me and gentle with
me. And he wants me to return and
wants,
you know,
good things for me.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is not, but you know, I think that if you proposed that idea of God to Christopher Hitchens, he'd go, yeah, that does sound lovely. Unfortunately, in practice, that's not what we actually see is being like, that is a lovely idea. And your personal experience with that is wonderful. If you could keep it to that and just go, this is my personal relationship with whatever I pray to or whatever, you know, then great, lovely. Yeah. But the second that you start going, these people need to die for this reason, or this, these people need to suffer or be subjugated because suddenly we're into territory where that doesn't line up with what you just told me about your your God.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I like the idea of being scared off. Let's get to the third thing that happens, and then we'll talk a little bit more about the concept of like anti-Mormon literature and stuff and how this book comes about.
The third event, it was kind of it started as a slow burn, I guess. Between like 2013 and 2017, I was really busy. I was overworked. I was always exhausted because of my chronic illness. So I fell into the camp. I think there's terms that people use now. It definitely became inactive, but only to the degree that when Sunday came around, I was too exhausted to attend.
Mm-hmm.
So I just took church on as a personal thing at home. Mm-hmm. I attended the temple too many times between all those years. And then around, I think like December 2017, a lot of things in my life, I had a lot of questions about how to like care for myself and how some of my views didn't align with some of the people I loved the most, and how to still have healthy relationships, given all that.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked with a therapist for just a couple months, and it inevitably she worked me through some like ethical and moral concepts surrounding my situation that convinced me to kind of start caring for myself better, regardless of what the church had been teaching me all these years.
This is kind of in regards to medication too, right?
Yeah,
that she's helping you understand like, is it more or less ethical to use opiates to treat chronic pain versus cannabis? Mm-hmm. And like, and what is the basis of that, of the ethics of that? Is it simply that you're a person who believes in following the law?
Yeah.
Or is it a religious, you know?
Yeah. It was a mixture of both. 'Cause at the time it was still even medically not a thing in Utah.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, it was because I tried like two dozen different medications to work through it, and cannabis was kind of the only thing I hadn't jumped into.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think one of the things that really convinced me is she did put part of it in a religious light, because she said, just, you know, a couple hundred miles to the east, there's probably some Mormon who's talked to their bishop about an illness they have, and they buy marijuana to help them with it. Because even the church, to a degree, allows, you know, medical intervention into the word of wisdom for individual purposes. So I was doing church personally at that time, so I didn't really have a relationship with the bishop. I didn't want to go talk to anyone about it. And so she just said, I just kind of got through that problem of, well, if there's a Mormon a few hundred miles away who has approval, and I know I've had this condition for almost two decades now, I don't think the God that I know is going to be upset that I took a plant that he made and made myself not be in pain every day anymore.
Which we could talk at length about the phenomenon of, and it's not just Mormon people, but people who are zealots about a particular church that they attend, people mm-hmm. who really, you know, firmly identify with it and really, and like, it is who they are, and don't you dare come after it, who don't know many of the foundational doctrines and like, and actual teachings of their church. If you actually ask them, like, have you ever read that? Or like, could you quote that to me? They can't.
No.
And they haven't actually, the Bible thumpers who probably have never read the Bible. They have had their Bible read to them by their pastor on Sundays, and they've had certain verses read and interpreted for them by their pastor, but they've never actually sat down and read it cover to cover and come up with their own assessment of it. And that the first time I read the Word of Wisdom, I was blown away. I was like, my whole life I've been doing this thing called the Word of Wisdom, which is and it was a thing that was told to me and interpreted for me by my leaders. It's just, we don't drink coffee, we don't do any drugs, we don't, you know, and that includes marijuana, we don't, you know. I go read the Word of Wisdom, and it literally says in black and white in there, anything that grows in the earth, I have put here for your growth and sustenance. And I'm like, well, that couldn't be less, I mean, couldn't be more clear. It is right there that if it's a plant, it's good for you.
Right.
If it is natural and it grows, and I'm like,
several plants that are outlawed by, I can't drink tea. Like, I'm not supposed to drink like certain hot teas. Coffee is a plant.
And it's not in that, those words aren't even in there. Like coffee, I mean, maybe it's I'm not wrong, in there. I mean, but no, I don't think the word coffee is in there.
The word coffee does not appear in the word of wisdom. People are interpreting it and basically creating colloquial interpretations and definitions of this thing. Most people, most active members of the church, if you ask them, have you read the word of wisdom, would say, would probably tell you, I didn't even know it was written down. Like, I didn't even know, like, there's like a place where I can read it.
But it's I've just been told I can drink Diet Coke, but not coffee. I've and
just been told which drinks I can drink and which ones I can't. And how crazy that, like, you're, this is a thing that you are basing like major life decisions on, and you've never, you're not even aware that it's a thing you can go check and like go make sure you're doing it right. First time I read it, I was like, holy shit. I mean, it's literally, and it makes sense. It's like, why would God create a plant that I, if I take it, I'm bad. But I guess that's one of the first stories in the Bible. So,
yeah. Well, one of the layers there too is how they really get you in, especially in indoctrinated members is, like my view was like, I even though it wasn't medically a thing in Utah, but like before I went and saw the therapist, I was like, yeah, I can see how medically that would be okay. And I think there are other members who like me, like I knew I had read the word of wisdom. But my view was more like, even though there's not specifics in here on all these other accounts where I feel spiritually confirmed, these guys who have been telling me all that are correct. So they must be right about this too. I'll just wait for further knowledge.
Is cannabis the thing that kind of cracks it open for you? Like, do you have some experiences listening to some Pink Floyd while trying to treat your fibromyalgia where all of a sudden you're like, whoa, like
no,
or like it, what, like it does, or does it lead to sort of an expansion of thought and consciousness, or like how does that go down?
It just really, it first of all, it took away the pain. It was recreational at first, so it wasn't always the best, and I was still working full time, so it wasn't all like always terribly effective.
Sure.
But it did definitely relax me and it helped ease a lot of like apprehensions that come with church, like being concerned about your salvation given any choice that you could possibly make and how your loved ones feel about how you're living your life. Like now that I've decided to smoke cannabis because it helps me, even though I can tell people who love me dearly that for the first time in 15 years, I don't feel pain.
Mm-hmm.
They're still disappointed that I made that choice because I might not be with them in the eternities.
That you weren't willing to tough it out because everyone has their crosses to bear and everyone, you know, even though we've got people in the church who have chronic pain issues who are addicted to legal opiates, who live on Percocet and Valium and Lortab and
more
and,
likely
and
to
Oxycontin,
overdose have,
and more likely to develop a debilitating issue, more likely to overdose, more likely to have kidney or renal failure down the road, more likely, you know, way less healthy things that, I mean, literally the history of the criminalization of marijuana, it's all just steeped in just racism and
100%, no doubt.
Yep, it's just this like bullshit thing that has nothing to do with morality, nothing to do with ethics. It's just some bullshit law. We've got a bunch of them and you know, just like the idea that there's something morally superior to with pharmaceutical chemical drugs versus, it's insane.
It really is.
And there's literally no data that backs it up whatsoever. In fact, if anything, the data is just
the opposite.
The 100% the opposite.
Yeah. Which was kind of one of the things, even as a member, I was like, well, yeah, but those are sciences we accept. Like we can see how it's medically relevant for certain people.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
Mormons will put an 11-year-old kid on Adderall who's having a hard time focusing in school.
Oh, no, you know? Doubt. Happens all the time.
And it's an amphetamine, you know? Like, I used to party on Adderall. Like, I used to, like, pop some Adderalls and go to the bar and, like, have myself a night. Like,
yeah.
Like, you know, and it's like, I'd be there doing it. I'd be like, they're giving this to kids? Like, I'm on drugs right now, dude. Like, yeah. Like, this is crazy. And just thinking like, yeah, here, Timmy, he has a hard time sitting still in class. Let's give him some meth. Like, that'll help, you know, like, and for certain people, it does actually, it creates a calming effect rather than a juicing effect. Yeah. It creates an effect where they can really focus on tasks and it, you know, but for me, it's like I just mainlined crack. Like it's, you know, it's crazy. So, okay, I imagine that even just that, the feeling of like that cognitive dissonance of understanding that what you're doing is technically
against what I believe and have believed for at least the marijuana stuff for like a decade at that point.
But also understanding at the same time that like I don't feel like I'm doing anything wrong. 100%. I feel like that's a thing that gets to a lot of people is daring, taking in your situation, it's like I'm literally in unmanageable pain most of the time, and it's created a very heavy burden on my life, and there has to be a way for me to not have to live in such constant pain. And so it's born out of like sort of a desperation, and so you're willing to take the risk of trying something that mm-hmm. is maybe counter to what you've always been told. And I think for most people that, I mean, this is a gateway, you know, a gateway drug, but trying something out that you've been told your whole life will sever your connection to God, that you will not be happy if you do that thing. Having the courage to try it and discovering that I'm still here.
Yeah.
Doing it and being like, I wasn't struck down. I still feel like me. I still feel like I have a connection to something spiritual.
Yeah.
And so that creates cognitive dissonance because you're like, well, if they told me that and that hasn't really panned out the way they told me it always would, what else hasn't panned out? What else might I be able to dip my toe into, or, you know, and was it sort of like that for you? Or?
Yeah, no, that's pretty accurate. It was. I mean, yeah, I don't like the term gateway drug.
Yeah, neither do I.
Now that I understand, like...
Because of the way that it's used to propagate.
Yeah, like people just don't know what pharmacological determinism is.
Yeah.
it really did. It first took away my pain, and yeah, like you said, was like, well, then what else could I like still feel good about that might help me, or that they may have been wrong? Because mm-hmm. I already had... like questions and wondering about like how I was thinking a lot, cause I was working on a play at the time that kind of dealt with Lehi's dream. So I was thinking a lot about, like death and how the universe is actually structured. Cause Mormonism has the whole Kolob and the Kokobam and where God actually resides. So there's a physicality to it. And so I was thinking a lot about how it really aligns with physical sciences that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of doing that kind of research in the light of, first of all, I guess a context, fibromyalgia, when you're in a lot of pain, it takes up a lot of brain power.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people with fibromyalgia live in a fog and we forget words very often, like even just how to structure a sentence.
Mm-hmm.
It was like for the first time in a long time, I had felt like I could think clearly too.
Yeah.
And so bringing in all this new science study on top of what I believed as a member, a lot of it wasn't really lining up. So I don't remember really how I made the next step. I know all of that was definitely an introduction,
mm-hmm.
but I inevitably started to think more about like people I loved.
Uh-huh.
Especially like a lot of it does when I finally cracked does have to do with the LGBTQ community.
Yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah,
sure.
Honestly, because people I love were involved, mm-hmm. and I came to understand that I probably didn't really understand how I felt that way because I had been told to just hide it and not, you know, experience it to any degree outside of temple covenanted marriage.
Yeah.
So I started thinking a lot about what it was for me and had some of my own experiences that inevitably, it was almost 1 year to the day later that I had that conversation with my therapist where I was just in crisis mode. I had so many dichotomous feelings and knowledge in my head that I'm pretty sure I was on the phone with my mom at the time, just screaming about everything that was in my head. And I, at the end of the conversation, I don't even remember what her advice was or anything that we really talked about, but I just remember I was down the street from my house. I hung up the phone and I just in that moment said, fuck it. I think I'm wrong. And I'm just going to start living how I feel is right for me. And at that point I took the next step. I didn't let go of like what it meant for the potential of having my family together forever. That was the hardest thing to let go and probably why I held on the longest. And even in that moment when I said, fuck it, I think I'm wrong and they're wrong, I wondered for a long time, okay, but this is the only religion, because I've read a lot of other texts, that says you can have the people you love forever if you do this and this and this. And over the course of the next few months, I wanted to figure out what that meant. And I inevitably stepped into some other substances, particularly LSD. I had a lot of stress. Oh,
that's a good one.
Yeah, I had a lot of stress and anxiety after I left.
Yeah.
About those things in particular. And I knew from minor experiences I had had with cannabis that there was something else there.
Mm-hmm.
And from things I had read and friends who had experienced it, I thought LSD would be a good way to look at it.
Yeah.
And there was a very specific moment where I got walked out into a Mormon church parking lot, actually, at like 10:30 p.m. And this person said, hey, hug a tree. And I hugged a tree and I like understood nature differently than I ever had.
Yeah.
Like that God didn't make that tree. And then we walked out into the parking lot and they just said, look up. And it was like in that moment when I looked up and my mind was working on a level that was relaxed and open, like I hadn't experienced before, even in the celestial room I had been in hundreds of times, I had this realization that the things I had been feeling and all the opposition was for naught, and that not only could I live my life freely, it's emotional.
Yeah.
Everything I'd experienced that up to that point and over probably that year and a half from 2017 to when I finally did acid in May 2019, it just like fell away. And I understood that not only could I live how I felt was right for me, for my health, for how I just felt naturally comfortable with other people, regardless their gender or beliefs or place in life. Not only did that ring true for me, but it absolutely 100% had to be true for everyone else.
Yeah.
And having that realization in that moment, that really stripped away any apprehension I had that I wouldn't have my family forever. I didn't knew what it meant at that point, but I knew that what I had been taught didn't need to be stringing me along anymore through the cosmos. And
sort of a release that you're like, I can finally let go of it.
Yeah.
I can finally release it.
And I think more importantly for me was because I was one of those Mormons, even though I had like the edgy thing and I was comfortable swearing and all that we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
Oh man, I lost my train of thought. Fibro's kicking in. what did we just say?
If you more so than a release. Than releasing it.
Yeah, it wasn't, the release for me was good, but the realization of the view of that it clearly meant the same thing for everyone else, even people I hadn't met, that was the real release from any doctrines that were just banging at my mind because of indoctrination, and I didn't know how else to understand the world the way that they had told me people needed to live, whether it's your role in life as a mother or a father, or how you perceive your gender or sexuality. I just knew it was wrong.
Yeah.
And that everyone should be free to do as they please, as long as they're not harming other people.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was the big release.
Wow. That is really beautiful. And I relate a lot to that. There's things in sobriety that I miss, and people ask me all the time, do you miss it? And I go, yeah, of course. You know, I'm fucking miss whiskey. Like, yeah. I like just simple things, but I definitely, you know, I've had some really beautiful experiences on LSD. What you were talking about, where my mind is open and I'm seeing and experiencing things in a way where realizing that I always thought, I had this conception growing up Mormon that like drugs is an altered state. It's not reality.
Not reality.
In fact, it's quite more real than my actual experiences. If anything, it's like super real.
Yeah.
It's the opposite. I don't go to a fantasy land. I don't go to a play land that my brain makes up and I start dancing with purple elephants that come in. I understand trees.
Yeah.
And
I know I'm here. I can tell I'm here. Uh-huh. I can just see light that I've never seen before. And,
yeah. I was sitting in Liberty Park once and I looked at this tree and I thought, so this tree is older than me, older than my dad, probably older than my grandfather. This tree is probably, you know, I said, there's a good chance. And I'm sitting there looking at this tree and it's breathing, you know, it's the tree, the bark is moving, it's breathing. It's doing what trees do. If you look at a tree sober, everyone hearing this, like, ah, he's crazy. Go look at a tree right now and like take a minute and meditate, like look at it.
Exactly.
It's alive. And you know, it's alive. We know this, but like it's breathing. It's taking in carbon dioxide. It's putting out oxygen. It's breathing. It's changing. It's growing. It's moving. Things are falling off. It's constant. It's very slow. It's moving. It's very peaceful, but it's always doing stuff. It's alive. But I had this thought. I was like, there's a chance. I mean, my grandfather was raised here, lived his whole life here. There's a chance that like many people in my lineage and people who have led to me have sat next to this tree, have moved by it, and this tree has just been here the entire time. Just, you know, like, yeah. And it's like this stuff that it's like, I know that people hear that and it just sounds like a, whoa, man. Like, yeah. But it's like, no, but that's not fantasy land. That's real.
Yeah,
that's
100%.
That's reality. That's truth. That's real. And we don't, the way I always describe it is your mind's like a filter, and it has to be evolutionarily for your survival.
Yeah.
You can't go around
computing everything. Yeah.
You just can't go around counting blades of grass. Like, you can't do that. And so it makes sense why our minds work the way that they work. It filters out unnecessary information and keeps what's necessary for us to be able to communicate with people and go about our days. When you're on psychedelics, psilocybin, or I prefer LSD, different people have different constitutions. Some people prefer psilocybin to LSD and vice versa. Something happens to the filter where it gets opened up and suddenly you can see and appreciate the design of the grain on a table that's wood.
Yeah, it's wild.
And you can really like spend time looking at the way that that grain was like formed, and you can look at a painting and get into the thickness of the brush strokes of the paint and like get lost in like, yeah, like the, like
the, I know what you're talking about, you know, the textures,
the texture
and
start,
the depth.
You can start to like see the hand of the artist in it, like moving across the canvas, and it's just these things that, yeah, again, you can't go around living your life like that, but what a gorgeous thing to experience, to be able to like really see through this next layer of reality and be like, oh, there's so much more here going on. And you can take that with you into sobriety. You can take that with you, this understanding that the world is a more marvelous place than we generally give it credit for.
Yeah. Oh, well, and the thing about that is it being like based in reality is the reason I took that step from okay, well, I do cannabis. It helps my pain. My mind's more clear. But I hear that this synthetic drug can take that further. So I was comfortable taking that step. But in that same moment, there was such a perception that it was based in something real. The reality of seeing the cosmos before me, where I knew no doubt that I wanted to start meditating.
Yeah.
And I've meditated every single day since.
Awesome.
I never looked back, because you can have those experiences in just a natural, meditative, comfortable, relaxed state.
That's such a fun part of the process of faith transition, is understanding that the experiences that you had that made you so confident in that faith are actually possible, and that you can actually have a more kind of open and
free
and expansive experience with those things, where there's less fear of doing it wrong or of...
Yeah, because you can't really do it. There's no wrong... Right. I mean, there are wrong ways to go about it, but to meditate and like have that experience, there's no real wrong way to do it. It is part of us.
Sort of like the humility and the willingness is kind of all there is to it. Just the willingness to... Because I used to have this issue with like, why does God or whatever it is need me to get on my knees before it can help me? Like if I'm struggling with something, if I'm struggling with anxiety, if I'm struggling with fibromyalgia, if I'm struggling with some chronic condition, how come I need to beg God on my knees before God will help me? What I found in sobriety and in this new spiritual program that I'm working is that it's not about this masochistic thing of kiss my ring and kiss my robe and maybe I'll throw you some crumbs.
Yeah.
It's a matter of you won't be able to tap into this stuff sufficiently if you can't humble yourself and be willing to be open to it.
Yeah.
So it's not about God's attitude. And I say God, when I talk about God, I talk about the energy of the universe, like the source energy that courses through, that gives force to the planets and stuff, you know, not a guy with a beard. But it's not about God's attitude. It's about my attitude. It's about, am I doing what I need to do to channel that and to be a conduit for that?
Yeah.
And,
well, I think part of the, like, there's no wrong way to go about it. The context there that you made me think of, the real reason there's no wrong way to go about it is because there is no expectation from the energy of the universe that you not be acting on your sexual feelings or drinking a whiskey or a wine with dinner. And like those expectations of living your life the right way aren't a part of meditation.
Okay, so you're doing drugs and
Mom.
It's so funny too, because like as a Mormon, you're like, well, what's wrong with that guy? It's like, oh, he's on drugs.
On drugs? No, absolutely. Yeah, he's
on drugs. You know, it's like, yeah, like you're doing drugs, and when does the idea for? Because you're a writer, and I've always known you as a quite prolific writer and a very ambitious writer too. Like I remember in college, you were like writing musicals and stuff, and you, which is like big thing for people to attempt. When do you get the idea that you want to start putting some of this stuff down in words?
Yeah. So like I mentioned earlier, I'd been working on a play for several years that was kind of along the lines of the story of Lehi's dream, but from some different perspectives.
Cliff notes for people who aren't Mormons: Lehi is the father of Nephi, who is one of the big characters in the Book of Mormon. His dad has a dream that they need to, they need to build a boat, go to America. But he also has this dream about this tree that has, it's a tree of light with a rod extending from it, and people are holding onto it to get to the tree of light. And on the other side, there's a big ravine, and there's a big and spacious building with evil people in it. And that's the dream.
Yeah, no, that's great. So I had a whole different take on that. but I was still doing it from a like quasi-religious perspective. When I just kind of decided, or discovered rather, that it was all bullshit, I was like, well, I don't want to write a religious play anymore.
Sure.
But I had some like good monologues in there that I felt like could still give context. So I worked with one in particular for a while, and a bit of it is actually still in there. I think it's the introduction of the second or third chapter. But it went through a few phases. At first, I was just kind of like, I'm upset about a lot of things. What do I talk about? And I felt like I could take a source text from the church and flip it on its head. So I kind of started with preach my gospel and for the strength of youth, and was kind of picking those apart section by section. And
that's what I thought was so interesting the first time you sent it to me, is I was like, this looks like a manual that the church would put out, which I think is so smart.
That was the original idea. Because I went into the mission field when they launched Preach My Gospel. So it was like a big thing of how I taught and viewed the gospel. But a lot of it didn't like culminate to an end that really...
You've got footnotes and stuff, like see the footnote, and the references go to this page, and like all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So I wanted to replicate that, and some of that still exists, but the topic itself didn't really speak to me. And so I'll, for those who are unaware, I don't know if I sent it to you in this form, but the original title was Bleach My Gospel.
You mentioned that a lot in the book, that like here I am bleaching the gospel.
Yeah,
you
I didn't sent it subtly to me in that a form. Couple
you
times.
Sent it with as anti-Mormon literature, but it's in there, and I was like, oh, that's and I think that's a funny idea
but then I was like, ah, that's kind of like not that great. So Megan and I, we were honestly, should we just tell where the title came about? Is that kind of where we were headed?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I wonder about what gives rise to the idea to write something like this. Because a lot of people would say, there's this thing that Mormons say where they're like, well, like, people can leave the church, but they can't leave the church alone. Why don't you just move on with your life? Why do you need to write a book about deconstructing Mormonism? And the funny thing about the concept of anti-Mormon literature to me is, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, is that whatever your deeply held belief is, whatever the lens you view the world through, it should be able to stand up to scrutiny, I think. I feel like the more research you do, the more you should be able to bolster your worldview. And if your worldview is afraid of... is threatened by information that pulls it apart or deconstructs it, I don't know. Like, and I understand that there are people who their entire job is to be apologists and to respond to deconstructive narratives and literature and stuff. But I mean, do you feel like you are motivated by like seeing specific harm done by the organization, or like?
Yeah, so I guess that kind of sparked some. It was a mixture of where it wasn't speaking personally. I thought, well, why maybe go back and deconstruct the things that upset you now that you wish had gotten you out sooner, that I should have deconstructed then.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess on top of all that is because I had talked to Megan a lot about like the content of it, but how I was unsure of trajectory and some of the content. And when I talked earlier about reading other religious texts and then reading Hitchens,
did you ever go back to Hitchens?
Yeah. So I didn't view those things that I read back early in college anti-Mormon literature. I considered them like anti-Christian or
anti-religion.
Other religion. Because they didn't, except for that one section in God Is Not Great, none of them were like, but Mormonism is wrong. I didn't read any of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm.
Have you ever seen the video of him getting into an argument with Brandon Flowers
with Brandon Flowers?
Yeah,
no.
Yeah. Brandon Flowers and
I don't think so.
And Christopher Hitchens are, oh no, it's not Hitchens. It's Richard Dawkins. Richard Dawkins and Brandon Flowers are on a talk show together. And he's like, well, I'm so sorry. He's like, it's clearly 18th century fan fiction, Bible fan fiction.
Yeah.
Like, very clearly. And Brandon Flowers is like, well, I'm very insulted by that. He's like, well, I'm not intending to insult you. I'm just telling you that, like,
he was a charlatan. Like, there's court records.
Yeah, like, yeah, he's a con man, you know? And Brandon Flowers is like, dude, like, you're really hurting my feelings. And it's like, yeah. Well, I'm not saying this to hurt your feelings. I'm saying, like, it's a matter of historical fact. It's a matter of historical record.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting, too, how... it feels like it's very hard to frame it in the right way. Was there any regard in your mind of like, I want this to be able to be digestible by active
yes.
members? Because like you had that experience of reading Hitchens and being like, like, is there a way or I don't know.
Yeah. So I did want to address that and I didn't get to that until a bit later in the writing.
Yeah.
And so like, I guess to say to that, like some people may have the same experience or reaction, but the difference would be that there's a much different arc to how like I wanted to end my story, because I wasn't necessarily going to tear about like all of God for all religions, like, you know, Hitchens is and God is not great, like that whole thing is just tearing it apart. And I got to probably, I guess, like you'd say, like phases of grief, like I got through the anger and I don't sit down and just like write all at once. It's like a chapter hits me every quarter kind of thing.
Do you almost feel like the beginning of the writing process was maybe a little more bitter, and then
absolutely.
And then the revision process was, how do I make this more approachable and digestible? Or
I had that feeling, but I just knew it, a lot of how it came out was too authentic and organic, and I didn't want to go back and edit that
sure.
part of me
sure.
because I knew too many people could relate.
Yeah.
I'm not an angry ex-Mormon anymore, but here's clearly a few chapters where I was and why.
Yeah.
But if you keep reading, you see that that's obviously not all there is to it. I wanted to, yeah, make it more comfortable and digestible and just bring about different ways of viewing how Mormonism may have been presented to people like I was.
Yeah. And so you go through things, like you said, that you think if this had been presented to me, maybe in this way earlier, maybe it would have gotten through.
It would have hit different, or I would have questioned some aspect of it sooner that would have started a domino effect. Who knows?
One thing that's very clear reading it is, that there's no shortage of insider information there being shared, that it's like for anyone who wants to go, well, this guy, you know, he's just a liar. He's just, it's like, no, this is, it's all very, very clear. It's kind of like the CES letter, which is like one of them, you know, where the CES letter, it's like, if you actually read that thing, it's very clear that this guy is a
believing member who knows a lot about the gospel.
That this guy is well-versed and well-read. Again, we go back to that thing of people who belong to or identify with an organization who aren't actually knowledgeable about what the organization actually teaches. And it's always the people who are the most knowledgeable who usually wind up falling away.
Yeah, no, 100%.
They read too much. And they're like, well, have you guys actually read this? Like, you read it and it's like the opposite of what we're, you know. And so, it's usually the people who can speak the most fluently on it, and other people who are believers, the best that they can usually give you is like, well, I don't really know how to justify it to you. It's just how I feel, which is valid, which is, I don't ever want to take away from someone like, great. If that's a thing that makes you feel better, safer, you know, helps you find an excuse to be of service to your neighbor, great. You know, where we have problems is when harm gets done. When
100%. Yeah.
If children are being harmed, or if kids are raised thinking that they were born into an abominable body and need to commit suicide to repent for the way that they're sexually oriented or their gender identification, we've got a problem there, you know?
And it persists to this day. It's, you can find it everywhere.
Yeah. I don't know. My hope is that active members or people who have questions will find what you've written and be brave enough to explore. Because that's really what it takes. It takes the willingness to, just like you did with cannabis, to be open and try something that you've been told, try that and you're going to regret it.
Yeah.
Try that and you're not, you might not come back. Be willing, you know, and open. And I think I even remember you putting that kind of in the book, that you're like, if you're going to go down this road with me, you need to,
yeah,
you know,
in a couple of places, I think one in particular early on. And I remember putting this in there. I think it's at the very end of one of the chapters where I talk about the free agency that they've been given from their God and what that might actually entail for someone like them, someone like I was when I was at TBM, reading a text like this.
Yeah.
And how they might or should view it differently and still take it in, regardless of them being told counter to the fact.
Over the years, I've read a lot of deconstructions of Mormonism and of other faiths and things like that, and a lot of atheist texts and things like that. I think that you do a really wonderful job of breaking down, for Mormons specifically, taking, you know, allowing the reader to know, hey, this thing, right? Let's take this.
Yeah.
I know what this thing is. Let's try for the sake of experimentation to look at it through another lens.
That was where I inevitably ended up, because it felt more accessible that way.
Yeah. I think I talked to you about this when I first reached out, because I was like, boy, the title's so damn good. And I always say that, but it's like, do you have any fear that that title alone will be like, well, it's a non-starter?
Yeah, 100%. And that's kind of, I went back and wrote like a preface in introduction and kind of addressed that. Because when I wasn't like sitting well with the Bleach My Gospel title, Megan and I were just sitting there in the kitchen talking about it. And like I said earlier, all the other things I hadn't considered anti-Mormon literature because they weren't covering Mormonism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Megan's same experience as us growing up in the church that way. So she's just paused and she said, well, why don't you just call it what it is, because that's what they'll call it, anti-Mormon literature, because it's about the church specifically and they're not gonna like it, they won't agree with it. I thought it was brilliant. I did worry that it might be a non-starter, but I inevitably, I think I addressed that well in the introduction.
When we're in the realm of fear and trepidation, I know, just as a content creator and as an artist, and I've talked about this on the show, that the process of releasing something can be existentially difficult.
Yeah.
I talked about this in the Bo Burnham episode, that there's an embarrassment with putting out something that you've put your heart into, especially, you know, you've been working and revising for well over a year now on this project. Are you feeling any fear with releasing it with how family will respond, friends, or are you at all trepidatious about backlash in any way?
No, I actually have a plan for a lot of it. For a long time, more so when it wasn't a complete piece. Yeah. Because I felt like if it didn't have nice buttons in a certain place to get points across that help people get past the fears and apprehensions, then it might backfire in a way that wasn't intended. Just the title itself, it did for a long time worry me how family would react. But again, this was something that Megan kind of got me through. She just said, well, that some of them might not even read it, and they might just be reacting to the title, and you of all people know, and I know, and those who have actually read it know what it actually entails.
Almost certainly there are people who will just respond to the title.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I feared that family would respond negatively, but it doesn't bother me anymore, because I'm at the point where I'm not going to push it on anyone, but if a family member comes to me and they're like, hey, I'm not sure about this and this anymore, gonna help them get through it.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think maybe the book for some of them in secret might start that process.
Just making yourself publicly available for that you're like, hey, I'm here if you need to talk about this, and I'm trying to have a conversation about this too. And knowing that some people from your past, maybe people you went to high school with, people you went to college with, people you were on the mission with, whatever, might see it and go like, oh man, lost his faith. Wow, damn.
Yeah.
You know, and have that thing where like, oh, that's too bad. I remember that early on that was really hard. I had to explain that to some friends recently because one of my friend's wives is like having a really hard time. Hmm. And she said, this is one of the hardest things I've ever gone through and no one really gets it because I can't talk to anyone about it. And one of my friends was like, I don't feel like we're not allowing you to talk to us. And I told him, I said, actually, it was really hard for me when I first left. You guys, I said, I know it wasn't your intention, but it didn't feel like I could talk to you guys because it didn't feel like you actually wanted to listen to the answers that I had for a lot of your questions.
Yeah, no,
you would ask me questions like what happened or like what changed. And the honest answer, I didn't feel like you actually wanted to hear. And so it was very difficult to have my entire support system and family and friends feel like, they feel like I've gone crazy. Mm-hmm. They feel like I've lost my way. They feel, you know, and yeah, trying to explain that to people that it's like, I know that you weren't intending to have me feel that way. I know that you were just responding through your lens and your experience, yeah. Which is, oh no, but like, it's very difficult, you know?
Well, yeah, especially, I mean, for individuals like you and Megan and others I've met online who really had to and went through it like pre-internet age, like internet existed, but you couldn't really Google things about the church like you can now. And there wasn't the supportive community there is on different social media platforms and whatnot for those who have lost their faith. So yeah, it is different in that way. Very much so. Like you more so went through it alone.
Yeah.
Like Megan has said, but there's,
at least that's how it felt. It felt like it was very much so a journey that I was on personally, and I was the first in my family to do it.
Same,
and so there was no one. I
who know, do you talk to about it? Because they don't want to hear
a cousin
it.
Or a, yeah. I would, you know. So I had friends at college that I could talk to.
Yeah.
And stuff, and I. But most of my high school friends, it was hard to talk to, and you know, and that's all gotten better. It's all gotten easier.
Oh yeah.
And one thing that I find helps that is being as respectfully transparent as I possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
I try not to ridicule my friends for their beliefs or their stances on things. I try not to go out of my way to be like offensive in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
But if they ask a question, I try to give an honest answer. And I try to be respectfully transparent. And I feel like that's the tone you're trying to strike with this book is if you read it, I'm going to be respectfully as transparent as I possibly can. And it's very well researched, very well thought out.
Thank you.
Yeah, and very well written. You're a good writer.
Thank you.
So yeah, hopefully it can be useful. I feel like it will. I feel like, you know.
I think it will be for many people. Because I see a lot of how I felt while I was writing it, because I keep to myself a lot. I don't necessarily need a big community or a whole lot of friends. It does help, but
yeah.
I keep to myself a lot, but I see a lot of people online say the same things or around the same things or struggle with the same concepts that I did.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it'll help a lot of people.
Where's the book available?
Amazon.com right now. Hopefully some other platforms in the future, but for now, just Amazon.
Right now, people can get it. Right now, if they go look up anti-Mormon literature by, is it Christopher Schoenefeldt?
Yeah. There's a subtitle too that helps. It's anti-Mormon literature essays they warned you about.
Essays they warned you about. God, it gets even better. I like that a lot. Essays they warned you about by Christopher Schoenefeldt. And is it Christopher Schoenefeldt?
Go by Christopher.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Excellent.
Been great.
This is awesome. I'm glad you came over. It's good to see you.
Me too.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
See ya.
All right. So again, look up that book. I got a chance to read it, and it's very, very good. He's a good writer, and he does a really nice job. You know, don't be scared off by the title, I would say. If there's anyone who's LDS who's listened to this episode and you've made it this far, don't be scared by the title. You know, give it a chance. I promise it's not as scary as it sounds. He does a nice job of just sort of deconstructing certain ideas that you've probably heard your entire life, and he does it with an insider perspective, a person who lived his entire life in the church. But let's go now to our favorite segment on the show. Let's go over to the TikTok, TikTok. We are live on TikTok. If y'all didn't know, if you listen to the podcast and you don't follow me on TikTok, it's been a big week on TikTok this last week. I've gained like 200, almost like 200,000 new followers in the last few days on TikTok. It's crazy. But let's see. Oh, Sarah Smart says she can help moderate. Thank you, Sarah. I appreciate it. Let's see. We got a lot of comments right now about my kidney stone because I was talking about that on social media that I had a kidney stone yesterday. And I passed it this morning. Thank God. I appreciate everyone for the comments on the kidney stone, but, so Aunt Lydia, oh God, I hate that screen name. Sorry, Lydia, but that's my least favorite character in all of fiction is Aunt Lydia. I want to, headbutt Aunt Lydia in her nose personally, and then kick her in, her butthole and, push her down a hill of spikes and thorns. Even though she's just a fictional character, I hate her more than Ramsay Bolton. I dislike her that much. But Aunt Lydia says, I just got here. What's this ex-mo talk? Yeah, that's what we're talking about. There's some ex-mo Mormons in the chat. But also, if you're a person who's ever been a member of a Christian denomination or religion and had a faith transition, anything like that. A lot of the episode this week is us talking about faith transition and how it happens and why it happens, the specific reasons that lead people there. And because people who remain faithful often think that it's like, like someone offended you at church, someone hurt your feelings, or you couldn't adhere to the strict guidelines of the church, and that's why you stopped going to church. You just wanted to party and do drugs. And hey, look, I did party and do drugs when I left the church, but also I left the church because I just was investigating certain questions that I'd always had, but that I'd never dared to look into. And the answers just were what the answers were. Ward Choir Director, that's a funny screen name, says, us ex-mos are all over these ticks and talks. There are a lot of ex-Mormons on TikTok. There's not a lot. Is there a Mormon TikTok? Is there an active LDS TikTok? I know that there's like a very big evangelical TikTok. I know that like there are like a lot of Christians on here like preaching really heavily on TikTok. But I don't know if there's like an active LDS TikTok. Is there? I'm sure there is. Kyle Ann, Kalia NH, maybe Kalia, New Hampshire. I don't know. I don't want to blow up your spot and say where you are. Says, did you go through the temple? No, I did not. I didn't make it that far. My guest on the episode this week did. He did go through the temple, and he's been through it many, many times. I did not go through the temple. I left the church when I was 18. I was supposed to be getting ready to go on a mission. I was so excited to go on a mission. And then I went to college, and I met a group of friends, just like the church warned me. They warned me about those friends. They said, you got to be careful about who your friends are. And I met this group of people that really challenged me, and they sort of like challenged me to step outside of my of the perspective that I'd been in my entire life. And boy, it's like once you dare to start taking steps away from it, and you dare to start investigating, it's just all over. And they talk about that in that Lehi's dream thing. They talk like it's a straight and narrow path. And if you're not hanging onto the rod, like you're going to fall right into the ravine. Now, what I thought was I was going to fall and tumble and my life was going to become terrible. It's not actually like that, or it wasn't like that for me. I definitely did fall away really easily once I started investigating things, but I didn't feel like I fell into a ravine and pit of misery. I feel like, my life just changed. But yeah, as far as the temple, let's get back to the temple. I did not go through the temple, but I was maybe 24, 23 or 24 the first time that someone sent me a YouTube video of a temple ceremony. And you can find, there was this old movie in the 70s called The God Makers that came out that was like an anti-Mormon movie that, you know, but it was literally these people who were ex-Mormon who performed the temple ceremonies in this movie and showed the world what Mormons do in the temple. And you can think of that what you will, if that's appropriate for people to expose, you know, sacred rites and rituals of a certain religion. the interesting thing about it is it's stonemasonry. It's stonemason rituals. But I, as a 23, 24-year-old kid, and Mormons will tell you this, active Mormons will tell you this, Mormons do not talk to their children about what goes on in the temple. It's so sacred and special that you don't, it's not discussed. So it's just sort of dropped on kids at the age that they either go on a mission or get married. For a lot of women, it's when they're going to get married. They go through the temple for the first time. And it's such a jarringly different thing. You grow up hearing people call your religion a cult, and they say that you're a member of a cult, and you guys are weird, and you're like, I don't know what they're talking about. The first time you see a temple ceremony, you're like, oh my God, that's why everyone says we're in a cult, because that's the cultiest shit I've ever seen. It's, you have to wear these very strange costumes, and there's secret handshakes and secret names that you whisper into each other's ears, and it is bizarre. There are hand gestures that you do. Up until 1990, people had to threaten to kill themselves if they told anyone what was going on in the temple by going like this across their neck. They would draw their thumb across their neck and their thumb across their bowels. You tell that to like millennial Mormons who went through the temple in like the 2000s, and a lot of them are like, that's not true. We don't do that. It's like, yeah, no, you did though, till 1990. Like, your parents did that. My parents did that. Ira Dog 85 asked, didn't the Simpsons poke fun with the stonecutters episode? I don't think they were poking fun specifically at Mormons, but I think they were poking fun at stonemasons. At stonemasons, which Joseph Smith was a stonemason. And again, like, this is what I'm talking about. At the beginning of the episode, I talked about how LDS leadership typically labels anything that goes against their narrative as anti-Mormon literature. And that would include coming out and saying Joseph Smith was a stonemason. They would consider that you are speaking against the church and the church's narrative, even though it's just a matter of historical record. It's not something I say to be offensive to my Mormon friends or family. It's a matter of historical record. The man was a convicted con man, and you can think of that what you will. Like, if you're LDS, you can think, well, yeah, he was a convicted con man because people didn't like him and they were persecuting him for his views. Like, you can interpret that however you want to interpret that, but it's a matter of historical record that he was a convicted charlatan and con man. He was a water diviner. He was a person who went around with a stick and tried to divine water. It's still a thing that, I mean, people did that all through the 20th century, and he was very into folk magic and things like that. And that's not something I say, again, to be quote unquote anti-Mormon. It's just a matter of historical accuracy that the Mormon Church, Freemason. Sorry, Mrs. Funk says, do you mean Freemason? That is what I mean. I think I was thinking stonecutters from Simpsons, which that other person brought up, and that's why I said that. This is an interesting thing. Gen X Papa Mo says, here's the issue. Do we, and then in quotes, rescue children from the church to prevent their indoctrination? Okay, so I just got done with season 4 of The Handmaid's Tale, and you know, in certain circumstances, I'm like, yeah. Like, when we're talking about FLDS, when we're talking about like the fundamentalist Latter-day Saints church where children are being married to men in their 40s and the men are consummating the marriage in public in front of a circle of people, there is a documentary called Prophets Pray. Pray spelled P-R-E-Y, meaning, you know, like prey, like a predator. And it is about the FLDS Church and Warren Jeffs, who was the prophet of the FLDS Church, who is now, thank God, in prison for sex crimes and pedophilia and rape and all kinds of things. And in that documentary, there is an awful section where they play audio from the temple ceremony where he was married to a 12-year-old girl when he was like 42, and he consummates the marriage in front of the elders of the community. And it is just the worst thing. It's just the worst thing. So if the question is, do we rescue those kids? Absolutely. Absolutely. It's Gilead. Like, And they address this in season four of The Handmaid's Tale, because, spoiler alert, actually, I'm not going to say it. If you haven't watched it, watch The Handmaid's Tale. I'll just say there's a lot of questioning the ethics of, okay, if a kid is being raised in a family, in a very religious community, and you kidnap that kid to get them away from that abusive community, are you doing a good thing, or are you ripping a child away from a loving home or the only home they've ever known? And they grapple with the ethics of that. I would argue in a situation like Gilead, in a place that evil and that terrible, that yeah, no, it's you have no choice but to try to get children out of that environment. And I think it's the same thing with the FLDS church. I was raised in the LDS church and in the LDS community, and I went through my fair share of things that I look back on and go, I'm not stoked on that. And I don't think that that was a great way to teach me that or do this or that. All that being said, my personal feeling is, and this is just based on my personal experience, is I would not advocate rescuing my nieces and nephews from my brother and sister-in-law or from my sister and her husband. Like, my siblings are very good parents, very loving people. There are a lot of really smart, loving, kind, compassionate Mormon people raising good kids who become good adults. Where it gets dicey is when you've got LGBTQIA plus youth in the household. It's kind of a mixed bag. Some households are very loving and accepting, as they should be. It only makes sense for someone who professes to be a Christian to have unconditional love for their child, no matter how their child identifies, and is oriented from birth. But not everyone is that lucky. Some people get parents who kick them out onto the street. So, boy, that's a tough question. That's a tough question of what do you do in that situation? Because it's not just Mormons either. It's religion the world over. There are people being raised in communities and cultures where there might be certain practices or ideas being taught in the household that person later on will have to unpack and deal with maybe some residual trauma from. And it's tough to answer the question of should those people be rescued from that household, especially if in many cases, if the household outside of maybe a couple things was more or less a good place to be raised. I think I had a net positive childhood. And again, that's my personal experience growing up in a LDS community and a Mormon neighborhood with all Mormon neighbors and all Mormon friends. I had a good childhood, and I had good friends with good families and a good community. And I don't look back on that and think I wish someone had come and rescued me. Kalia asks again, how did your family react to you leaving the church? Are they open to talking to you about it? So like I said earlier, I've been out for 15 years, so it's been quite a while for all of us to sort of come to terms with this. It was a very difficult transition. I will say that. It was many years of not seeing eye to eye and not being able to communicate very well about it. We spent a lot of time when we would get together avoiding the topic. My sort of stance, and I think theirs too, was we'll try not to talk about it. The difficult thing is their church encourages them to talk to their friends and family members who are struggling with their faith. And so they're feeling like they're not doing the right thing if they don't every once in a while try to approach the topic. And this doesn't happen anymore, but this was early on. Early on, I feel like they felt obligated to every once in a while see if they could have a conversation with me about it, to kind of see if they could try to see where I'm coming from, but also coax me maybe back in a direction toward maybe going back to attending. But those conversations never went well because I don't think that they were prepared for my answers to any of their questions. And this is what I've expressed to my friends in the years since, is my LDS friends, I've had to tell them, oh, that was like the hardest time of one of the hardest times of my life, leaving the church, because you guys would ask me all these questions, seemingly trying to get inside my worldview and trying to understand me. But every time I tried to answer you, it got really hostile really quick. And it didn't feel like I was creating that energy. It felt like all I was doing was answering the question. And my answer was very offensive and abrasive to you. Like it's almost like the answer they wanted me to have when they say like, well, what happened is that I just said, I don't know. This guy at church really bugged me and said something mean. And then they could go, well, you know, not everyone's like that. Like, that's what they're hoping. But they're like, well, what happened? And I'm like, oh, I looked into it and Joseph Smith married a bunch of children. Did you know that? Like, he was a bad guy. And also Brigham Young was like super racist. And also, like, the more I think about it, the church's history of misogyny and homophobia, like, really doesn't sit right with me ethically or morally. And like, that would ruffle feathers and it would cause a big uproar and a fight and an argument. And I wasn't saying those things to be offensive. I was saying them because they were the honest answer to the question of what happened. And it didn't feel like they were able to hold space for that. And I understand it. I get it. The most frustrating thing about leaving a church like that is that, and trying to have conversations with people who have never left and have done that their entire life is I would try to voice this sometimes. Again, I don't really have these conversations anymore. These are conversations that happened early on, the first 3, 4, 5 years after I left. And we're now all on good terms and everything. But early on, it's like I would try to explain to them, hey, listen, I know your position. You're trying to argue your position to me, but I know your position. I lived your position for the first 18 years of my life. I am intimately acquainted with your position. You don't know my position. You've never dared to try on my position as an intellectual exercise. You've never dared to like open your mind and heart up to the possibility that I might be saying something worth listening to. So that's a difficult conversation to have. Someone asked, I lost the question, but someone asked, do you still love Jesus? Cakes048, do you still love Jesus? I like the idea of Jesus. I think the idea of who Jesus is, I'm so baffled by the concept of Jesus because I don't see Christians, and it's not just Mormons, but I don't see Christians being Christ-like. Ever. Like I really, everything about modern American Christianity is backwards. There's this kind of philosophy that the richest person is the best person. The person who's been able to make the most money is obviously doing something right because God is rewarding them with riches, which is just like the opposite of who Jesus was and what he preached. People admire these preachers in super churches like Joel Osteen, who's just a multi-billionaire, and they look at them and they're like, wow, a man of God who is reaping God's reward, who it's clear that he's evil, like he's like clearly a supervillain. And it baffles me because if you'd read even just the most basic surface level internet search about Jesus, like look up who is Jesus and what was he about on Google, it's like not hard to figure out that that's not what people are doing. So yeah, I don't know. I like the idea of Jesus. I'm not sure if Jesus existed or was a real person. I definitely don't think Jesus was the Son of God. If there was a preacher from Nazareth who was very popular at that time, I don't think that he was the flesh and blood Son of God who had sex with a 14-year-old girl and then she gave birth. I don't think that happened. But sure, I love the idea of people being Christ-like and being kind and compassionate to the poor and afflicted and you know, inasmuch as you have done it unto the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me. I love that. Yeah, it's great. Lots of good stuff that Jesus says. I just don't see it in modern Christianity. Well, thanks so much for all the comments and questions. That was fantastic. Lots of good stuff to chew on and think about. And I'm sure that I missed a ton of questions and comments, but thanks for being here and participating. People Pleaser is written, edited, hosted, and produced by me, Austin Archer, with original theme music also by me. You can find more of my music by going to austin-archer.com, looking up Austin Archer wherever you stream music, or going to austinarchermusic.bandcamp.com. That's my favorite one. It's Bandcamp Friday this Friday. Bandcamp waives their service fee and gives 100% of the proceeds to artists. Go do that on this Friday, this upcoming Friday, Bandcamp Friday, first Friday of every month. We love it. AustinArcherMusic.bandcamp.com. My music is mixed and mastered by Chris Bjorn, as is this podcast. Chris Bjorn over at Marmalade Music. He's the best in the biz. Go to TheMarmaladeMusic.com to work with Chris. Tell him that I sent you, and he's going to give you 20% off your first project. How about that? That's awesome. Again, themarmalademusic.com. Chris will make your audio thing sound amazing. And tell him that I sent you for 20% off. Sweet Mama J is the moderator for our TikTok portion. And today, Sarah Smart helped out. Thank you so much, the two of you. Really, really appreciate it. We love you so much. Go look up Anti-Mormon Literature by Christopher Schoenfeld. It's available now on Amazon. Patreon.com/AustinArcher to support the show and the content that I make. Right after I get off this, I've got a Zoom hangout with my Patreon patrons that you, casual listener or TikTok person, don't get to come to. You're not invited to it. But if you're one of my Patreon patrons, then you're invited and you get to come hang out on Zoom. How fun is that? Patreon.com/AustinArcher. Go check that out. Support the show if you can. I think that's everything for now. Let's all pray that I don't have another stone rattling around in there somewhere, because I would hate that. And it feels like I might, but I'm also just hoping that I'm just sort of beat up from yesterday and just feeling residual pain. Drink lots of water. Don't get kidney stones. Love you so much. See you next week. Bye.